Welcome, everyone, to another broadcast of Timeless Esoterica on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can find them in podcast form at artistfirst.com. Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, the host of the broadcast, the paranormal professor himself, Dr. Bruce.
Welcome to Timeless Esoterica on artistfirst.com. I'm your host, Dr. Bruce, the paranormal professor. On this show, we'll explore topics including the paranormal, alien life, mysteries, conspiracies, hidden history, oddities, and more. Please check out my latest book, Timeless Deja Vu, on Amazon. I'm very honored to have as my guest this evening Dr. Edwin M. Young. Dr. Young received the Outstanding Senior in Electrical Engineering Award, among other honors, when he graduated from Notre Dame in 1973. He then worked at Westinghouse's Advanced Reactors, Pressurized Water Reactors, and Research Laboratories divisions, including electric vehicles, back in his Pittsburgh hometown for a year before a full Dean's Fellowship offer from Stanford University took him out to the West Coast for MSEE and PhDEE, and that's electrical engineering, studies that included running a highly controversial psychic research laboratory on the Stanford campus. Upon graduation in 1985, he was invited to join the MIT Lincoln Laboratory think tank, conducting research on microelectronics, where he remained for several years before being invited back out to the West Coast to Silicon Valley in an executive-level position at Digital Equipment Corporation's million-dollar-a-day advanced computer operations, where he guided highly technical diagnoses of product quality issues. In 1992, he finally gave up the security of a normal job to do private consulting and daring to widely publish long-hidden truth from the little mountain country town of Tehachapi, California, I hope I pronounced that right, north of Los Angeles, near Edwards Air Force Base, China Lake Naval Weapons Center, and who knows how many related secret underground facilities, where he remains to this day a thorn in the side of the deep state. Welcome, Ed.
Well, good to be with you, Bruce. You're the first person that I feel comfortable having an interview with that I've been asked many times, particularly since I quit publishing my magazine in 2003. So I feel good about this, and I'm happy to be on board with you.
Well, thank you, Ed. I'm very honored to have you as my guest, and I can say as a mentor to me too. In this journey that we're all on, I think is a good way to maybe put it. Since I'm a historian, I'll start with the beginning. You know, Ed, where were you born and where did you grow up?
excuse me. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, okay. Where I grew up. Went to grade school and high school there, and I really hadn't gone anywhere until Notre Dame. And after Notre Dame and working at Westinghouse, I was back in Pittsburgh, so I really hadn't been anywhere until Stanford gave me the fellowship and took me out to the West Coast. That was a big deal for me.
Well, that is a big deal. So how did your mom and dad influence you with your career choice and, you know, the work that you've gone into, that you went into?
Oh, that's a very insightful question to ask, because my mother and dad were both hardworking people. My dad was in the car business, Chevy dealer back in the days when the only argument there was Chevy versus Ford on the East Coast. Nobody heard of Toyota in those days.
Right.
As I got older, I realized that how smart both of them were. Neither of them went past high school, but there's something about natural intelligence and leadership abilities and things like that. And as I grew older, I became more appreciative of what they conveyed to me through their daily actions, their personalities, the people they interacted with in the community and relatives. And so I have a great appreciation for both of them. They're both gone now.
Yeah, they're both gone, is that what you said?
Yes, they're both gone now.
Okay. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're talking about, and I know we had talked earlier about that Mark Twain quote, right?
Yes, indeed.
You want to share that with our listeners?
Yeah, it's a good reminder to anybody listening to your show who, particularly if they have teenagers or about to be teenagers, because Mark Twain nailed it well over 100 years ago when he said, when I was 16, I thought my father was the most stupid person in the world. And by the time I turned 21, I couldn't believe how much he had grown. Go ahead.
That's great. I went through the same thing. You know, I appreciate my parents later on. And both of them went through about 6 years of formal education, which was normal in northern Norway in those days. So my mom was born in 1919. Interesting year to be born, and my dad was born in 1915. So they lived through the worldwide depression and all that, and then World War II, of course. They're trapped there under Nazi occupation. So so much wisdom there from that generation of folks, you know.
Yeah, they're the same age as my parents. My mother was born in 1915, mm-hmm. and my dad in 1916.
Yeah.
So my mother used to tell me stories about during the Depression, the big deal for lunch at school was a ketchup sandwich.
Oh, man. Yeah.
piece of bread with a thin layer of ketchup on it. That was it for lunch.
Those were hardy people, that survived all that. And I often think about, I think I could have made it, but I have such an appreciation for what they went through and what that whole generation went through, and here in America, but also, worldwide, because that Depression era, it was a worldwide depression. So,
yes, it was. It affected many, many people in families, particularly trickling through family lines. It affected many people, and when you're dealing with what your parents were dealing with, that's a very frightening layer of I don't know what to call it, but oppression.
Exactly. Now, I know I've shared with you before when we've spoken that my mother was very intuitive and she was actually very psychic, and I think that she passed that on to me. Were your either of your parents very intuitive and sensitive that way?
Good point. Yes, both of them. Mm-hmm. Both of them were, but I didn't. I took it for granted. There was nothing dramatic. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the one or the other of them saw ghosts or saw this or that or anything of that nature. But I watched them as I thought back over their interactions with people, and that they had a sixth sense that they used in everything they were doing, and they passed that on to me. Now, mine is a little more pronounced, but I don't really know, but it's so general that I don't know what I got from whom. But for instance, my dad's abilities, I saw them when he was interacting with people who came in to buy a car or the people he worked with. Yeah. How you handled the people, how he was kind to people, and then you would get back in those days. Oh, there's just one kind of story I would share that all of his salesmen would mutiny if a person came in with a certain attitude and the clipboard. They're going to save some money. They're going to go there. Anyway, my dad always called this person, and the salesman would call this person the pipe smoker. The pipe smoker. And his salesman would say, I'm not going to deal with him. I'm not wasting 2 hours of my time on this guy that is going to go away. And my dad would just go up to him and say, look, you know, well, the person would say, well, I can get this car for so much cheaper there. I says, go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
I did it there, and he says, if you find out you might be wrong, he didn't criticize it. He said he would say, if you find out you might be wrong, then we're here.
Yeah.
And inevitably, the pipe smoker would be back again, this time humbled, a little more humbled.
Right. Well, your dad sounded like a very honest, straight shooter. And people, you know, they didn't sense that right away, but your dad was very confident in that. And I you know, my father, although he wasn't intuitive and, you know, like my mother in terms of being psychic, but he was the kind of person that, and maybe I think it sounds like your parents were too, a handshake and, you know, look at somebody in the eye and a handshake, and that was your word, that was your bond. You didn't need a piece of paper.
Yeah, they were salt.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were salt of the earth people. They were honest. They didn't have a mean bone or a dishonest bone in their body. And that's what I mean by certain kinds of psychic abilities are conveyed in almost a subconscious way.
Right.
And that sensing the other person's, I would say sensing the other person's energy field, if I were to put it in technical terms.
No, I think you're right. I think that's exactly right. Now, Ed, did you have any military service at all? I can't remember in our discussions if you...
No, I didn't. I was at Notre Dame when the, I don't know if you remember, but there was a point where they had a lottery.
Yes.
Do you remember the lottery?
Yes,
the
draft lottery.
I remember, yeah, it might have been my freshman year. It might have been 1969 in the fall or spring of 1970, my freshman year there. I just remember a whole bunch of us huddled around the radio. You think it was 1940, and we were listening to War of the Worlds or something on the radio, the way we were huddled around the radio and sweating gumdrops, because if they were giving a number to a birthday, to a day. So you watched for your birthday, and then what number you got. And some people, if you had numbers between, say, 1 and about 40, you needed to be concerned a little bit. Certainly 1 to 20 needed to be concerned, and then maybe up to about 40, 45. My number was 343.
Oh. Thank goodness.
But then it wasn't very long. Was it, when did Nixon, there was some point at which the war ended, and Nixon ended the war, and you know, there wasn't any more. It's a little vague for me, but you probably remember the history better back then, but there was a point at which your number became a moot point in the scheme of things.
Yeah, because they were in such a phased withdrawal towards the end. By January 73, it was all over for us, and, you know, there were a few people left behind, and then we handed it over to the South Vietnamese, so... And then the draft, I think, ended. The draft was still going on for a little while, but right around then, 73, 74, you know, when... And then, of course, of course, Nixon was in big trouble then.
Yes, he was. He had his own problems. I just remember it was the people with a low number who might have been in college who were concerned.
Yes,
But I cannot recall anybody among my friends that had a low number and maybe got drafted and, you know, had to leave school. I don't recall anybody being affected, but that just might be my faulty memory.
Well, I think it's you know, I was thinking about my brother, because I know you and my brother are about the same generation. I think my brother graduated from high school in 67, so you're a little bit after that, right?
Yeah, I graduated in June of 1969.
Yeah, so he's 2 years older than you are. And for a lot of our listeners who are younger, this idea of, you know, waiting for your number or having to worry about the draft, and my brother volunteered.
Registering.
Yeah,
registering,
I mean, it's, I try to, when I teach my students about Vietnam, I try to do a little, you know, thought exercise, you know, what would you do? You know, what would you do? And you know, thinking about all this, my brother volunteered because, you know, there were millions that volunteered to avoid being drafted, which to my students sounds kind of weird. Why would you volunteer? But it's because if you were drafted, you were going to go into the Army or the Marine Corps, and you were going in the infantry, and you were going to go right to Vietnam. So that was, my brother wanted to avoid that if at all costs.
Yes. Yeah, you're bringing back memories now. That's right. It was, and it was a scary time, not just because the ones that were coming back from the war were being treated so poorly. You know, why go after the kids? The war, there was reason to protest an unjust war, but don't shoot don't get mad at the person who was drafted and had to go over there and fight. It was misplaced anger mismanagement.
I totally agree with you, and I remember I saw this documentary, and there was these two families, and they each had a son, you know, Vietnam age, and one of them went to school and avoided the draft, and another one went into the Army, and the person who avoided the draft, the other family wouldn't speak to them anymore, even though they were lifelong friends. Because they said, you know, my son is serving proudly and your son is, you know, getting out of it or whatever. And then as it turned out, the boy who was sent to Vietnam, he died. And the parents that were so adamant about their son going to Vietnam, later on, they, you know, in this heartbreaking documentary, they said, thinking about it now, I would have done everything I could to get my son from going to Vietnam, even if he had to go to Canada, anything it took. Now at this point, and I think people forget that, you know, the time that I was just little then, but I remember my brother going through all this, and it's important for young people to understand that, you know, what people were going through.
Yes, and then that brings in the subject of the mind control.
Yes,
fake patriotism.
Yeah.
That's not new. I mean, you have Hollywood generating this kind of thing all the way back to World War I, World War II, Korean War. The idea that you're not being patriotic unless you go off and get killed.
Yeah.
I never could fathom that, and perhaps that was one of my early psychic abilities was such a strong I could see what was going on, and it really messed with your mind, like you're saying. There were people who they knew they were supposed to wave the flag and send their son off to war, but boy, you know, somewhere inside, their own intuition in that must have been making their stomach churn.
Yeah, and I've worked with these veterans since I've, you know, been teaching the Vietnam War for 24 years, and I've seen these guys, and they are not a healthy group. Compared to the World War II guys, they're dying at a much younger age just because of what they were exposed to and how they were treated on their return, you know, and all that stuff.
Well,
and it's just, that's a whole other show. We could talk about that a whole other show.
I was going to say you're getting into the good stuff, because the first generation of implants that were kind of large, but they still got them into the kids, were the Korean War. By the time of the Vietnam War, the implants that you got during basic training in one or more of your shots during boot camp or whenever, they were well perfected at that point and quite tiny. So a lot of the mental problems that are you see among people I know from the Vietnam War era myself, you know, that's my age group, not only do you have the psychological aspects that you just mentioned, but there are the remnants of the chips that are still in these people.
That's horrible.
And that has an effect on their energy field too. Then it's a residual effect. So I would just love to have a device and be able to just nullify all of those chips.
Oh, me too. And, my brother, he suffers quite a bit, you know. He has Agent Orange, leukemia. He's got PTSD. He's got, he's got the full range of things. And I wish I could make that all go away, too, and those guys could live in peace and with their families. And unfortunately, they're not. And I feel for them, that whole generation. Speaking of implants, I know that's a very interesting topic. So is it, I remember when I was in the military, they were going to give us some big shot, and they said it was this big, it wasn't like a regular, like a needle, it was like something. I asked the doc, what is this? And he said, I'm not at liberty to tell you what it is. And I said, well, I refuse. If you can't tell me what it is, then I can't make a conscious decision about what, this is something I want in my body. And he said, well, you're going to have to.
You signed a form.
Yeah, I know.
You signed a form, and somewhere in all that little tiny print says we can make you a guinea pig.
Exactly. So the bottom line, long story short, they said, you're going to have to go talk to the commander, because we're going to put you up on report if you do this. And I said, that's fine. I'll go talk to the commander. And I went and talked to him, and he tried to talk me into it. And I said, sir, are you giving me a direct order? I just want to make this clear. Are you giving me a direct order to take this shot? And he goes, no, I'm suggesting that you do it. And I said, that's all I need to know. Thank you, sir. So I refused it. So who knows what that was? I don't know what that was. I still don't know what that was.
Wow. So you did not get that shot, huh?
I didn't get it. I just was very suspicious. And it's like you're saying, the psychic, this is just, there's something really wrong here. And they're, but who knows? They might have slipped something into me anyway at another time that I don't know about. So.
Well, maybe. But I have a friend who's in his 80s who's from the Korean War. And we've had many discussions about this subject. Partly I was introduced to this person because of a free energy device he had worked on a number of years ago, and they tried to poison him. They didn't quite succeed, but they certainly have made him miserable. But he talked about how his arm swelled up and how he felt weird for a couple of weeks after. And there were other side effects I don't remember right now. But that was the chip, the first generation at the Korean War era. By Vietnam, they had things down to a science. And heaven only knows what the kids right now going into boot camp are getting shot with.
Oh, I know. And we're going to circle back around to this topic of implants and stuff. Tell me about your time at Stanford and this psychic research lab, and I'm just fascinated by that.
Well, that's a really big subject, and I I have not talked about this before. Mm-hmm. An editorial in my magazine back in July of 2003 was the first time I mentioned a little bit about the subject, but let me say, the first year I was out at Stanford, I was working on my master's degree, and that the Stanford expects you to complete a master's degree in 3 quarters.
Okay.
So
that's pretty aggressive.
Yes, it is. Yeah. As an academic, you can appreciate that.
Yeah.
So that was from the fall of 1974. through the spring of 1975. At that time, I was so bored with... I had been at Notre Dame, and I had a certain perception of how knowledge and interaction with people in the pursuit of knowledge and the whole good side of the academic world, how that should go. So when I got the fellowship for Stanford, I erroneously projected that upward, saying, well, if Notre Dame was like this, then Stanford should be like this, mm-hmm. on a graph, even higher. Well, boy, was I wrong. the environment at the so-called premier prestige universities is very much more like a pressure cooker. And there's a lot of cheating. This is a whole subject, as you know. We've had a little discussion on this, but there is so much cheating, high pressure for professors to produce papers, mm-hmm. slice the bologna as thin as you can, get as many papers out, use your graduate students are looked upon as your slave labor
right.
to get your work out, and undergraduates are a nuisance that you just have to deal with every so often. I've simplified the discussion by what I just said. I was so shocked by what I saw at Stanford that and as it got to the end of the three quarters, sort of in the third quarter, while you're working on your master's degree, it is your obligation to go around to different professors, make yourself.
I'm here.
Oh, sorry. That was a dropout. I don't know what's going on. Maybe somebody just trying to say hello.
Oh, okay. All right. I paused it for a minute there, but now we're back. We're recording again. So
we're back, and yeah. It can be edited. But anyway, so yeah. So we were so in by the time the fellowship is strictly speaking for the master's degree work, so that. And your obligation, they expect you to introduce yourself to different professors that are working on different things and find a match where you would then continue into your PhD work with various oral exams and things you with that professor because there's a match there. There's a marriage. You know, yes, you like to do this kind of work. I need somebody who can do this kind of work, and you know, this will be a good PhD thesis. So you follow where I'm going with this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I need to give you that little bit of a background. That's the game plan. But I was becoming more and more jaded with the with what I was seeing at Stanford, and I even remember saying to my mother back in Pittsburgh. I said, go pull out my files out of my file cabinet at home, as I had other offers besides the Stanford. I said, I think I'd rather continue to pursue my education somewhere else. But around that same time, a very famous professor in the world of psychic research at the time, not Russ Targ and Hal Puthoff up the road a mile at SRI, and I'm not going to mention his name because he's still with us, and I eventually had him forced into early retirement because of the way he treated his graduate students.
Mm.
So I don't want to dwell on that point other than to use it as a general paintbrush to let you know how professors, shall we say, often borrow their students' work and claim it as their own.
Right, right. I got you.
That's a common thing to have. So what happened was this famous professor gave a talk at a psychic forum that I was part of, and I went up to him afterwards because that's what I really wanted to work on, was the psychic research. And, of course, I only knew him from his reputation at that point. So I went up to him, and I said, you know, is there any chance of working with you? And he said, well, he said, I don't have any funding right now. And so he said, no, there's no chance. Now, understand you are supposed to be polite and, you know, all the niceties of schmoozing with professors.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay. As a graduate student, you know, yeah. The handshake and all that. Well, yeah. Not me. Not me. I went up to him, asked him those questions, and he said, no, there's no possibility. And out of my mouth comes, well, let me just tell you that your situation is going to turn around. You're going to have funding very soon, and so I said, keep me in mind at that point, because it's going to turn around, and there's important work to do. And he kind of looked at me like, well, who are you, arrogant little twerp? So I forgot about it. I went, that was it, you know, and it was about five, 6 more weeks, and I remember I was driving back to my little apartment where I was sharing an apartment with another ex-Notre Dame student who was at Stanford, and I was driving back to the apartment, I thought, well, Ed, it's over. You know, you don't have anything lined up. You don't care for the crap that some of these professors are calling scientific research. You're not interested in that stuff. I guess I'm just going to go back to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I pull in the driveway, and my roommate comes out and says, "Don't even get out of the car." He said, "This professor so and so that I won't mention just called, and he wants to see you right away." So I just backed the car up and went right back over to campus and walked into his office, and he said, "I would like you to take over my psychoenergetics research."
Mm.
And I said, "Okay, that sounds good." And then I said, "Well, what changed?" He said, "Well, you were right." He said, "Funding did come in, and I have some funding for a while. Don't know how long it'll last." No, and so at the time, I took it as a nice honor, and I just, you know, thought, oh, boy, this is going to be good and fun, which it was for a while. But at the time, I was too dumb, young, and naive also to realize to look at this from the professor's point of view. Because this guy, being ambitious and wanting to make a name for himself, and that he goes, oh, look at this horse in my stable.
Yeah.
This horse in my stable is really psychic and can predict things. You know, he can really boost my pizzazz coefficient. So is this making sense, I'm saying?
Yeah, how this came about. Yeah.
So that's how it came about.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the next several years, that's what I worked on. I was so delighted with having something that I thought was important to do and useful to do, I paid very little attention to whatever courses I was taking because I was having a lot of fun. This particular professor was the one who brought Kierlian, for those of you in your listening audience, this person brought Kierlian photography back to the United States from the Soviet Union. The original, I don't know if you're familiar or I need to talk about what Kierlian is. It's taking pictures of things and showing an aura around your finger or around a leaf or something.
Right. No, that's, yeah. Okay.
People can look that up, up Kierlian photography.
Mm-hmm.
But the Semyon, it was named Kierlian because that was the last name of the two people over in Russia, the husband and wife team, Semyon and Vladimir Kierlian. I can't remember their names now. Kierlian was their last name.
Okay.
And so this guy brought this over, back over here, and wrote some initial papers on the technical side of Kierlian photography. I don't want to scare anybody by talking technical, but we're talking about the high voltage electrical breakdown of gases.
Mm-hmm.
So no different than lightning. So Kierlian, in a simple sense, is no different than you shuffling your feet across the carpet and touching your dog's nose and seeing that spark, or touching a doorknob. The only thing is, if you do that in the dark and you put a piece of film between you and the doorknob, between the end of your finger and the doorknob, then sometimes interesting things can happen.
Hmm.
As a result of stop me if I'm not making sense.
No, you're making sense. No, this is interesting.
I'm trying to keep it simple.
Yeah.
So the initial papers before I got on board, the initial papers about the process, because all the weirdos started saying, "Oh my goodness, this is, we're photographing the aura, and we're doing everything that's just really psychic and great." And so out comes the paper with all this technical information about how what is actually going on is the high voltage breakdown of the gas between your finger, say the end of your finger, and a piece of photographic film. Well, a lot of people didn't want to hear that. They were having too much fun saying it was an aura and that it was this and that. And of course, a number of them were not at the intellectual level to be able to read the technical paper. So that at the time I entered the scene, that was the situation. And I said to this professor, I said, yes, but there are certain anomalous phenomena that happen with Kirlian photography that are not simply the electrical breakdown of the gases in a strictly scientific manner. Let me give you an example. A good example would be what's called the phantom leaf effect. If you put a leaf on the, let's assume you have a little platform, and a copper, say shiny copper, and you put a piece of film on it, and this is in the dark, and you put a leaf on the, and then you put another piece of film, and you put the other electrode on the top, and then you zap it, okay, with a little, with a quick high voltage, you know, about the same length of time that you could picture a flash bulb if you were taking a normal picture in the dark with a flash bulb, only now we're using an electrical pulse. So, and then you develop the film, and there's the picture of the leaf with the aura, the glow around the edge of the leaf. Well, that's the high voltage breakdown of the gases around the leaf. Okay, now, what happens if you cut off a corner of the leaf? If you cut off a corner of the leaf and put it back on the little device and take a picture, not all the time, but sometime, the missing part of the leaf would be in the image.
Hmm.
In other words, so we called it the phantom leaf effect because it was as if the aura of the leaf was still causing selective breakdown of the gas in a contour that outlined the leaf that isn't that piece of the leaf that isn't there anymore.
Oh, wow.
Are you following this?
Yeah, wow, that's...
Okay. You can look this all... This is all ancient history to me. But
yeah.
But anyway, so we have that kind of example, and then we have people like Uri Geller and others in those days. Uri was just making a name for himself then, and in the 70s, and he was one of the people I remember being able to modulate the way the picture looked around his finger. In other words, he could make the picture, instead of being kind of around your index finger in that rounded form of your finger, he could make it maybe look triangular.
Mm.
Okay, and I'm going, okay, there's something, and I said to this famous professor I was working with at the time, I said, there are exceptions to the general rule that are in the paper that you wrote. And I said, I think what we have going on here is a subtle effect that is non-physical, but it's being buried and diluted in the raw electrical breakdown. The lightning, the miniature lightning, is overshadowing this subtler effect. So I said... So I invented a detector. I called it in slang language we call it the cell because it was about the size of a sandwich, and about as thick as a sandwich. And what the purpose of it was now. Oh, and then there were other effects. For instance, depending on when you last washed your hands. For instance, what was on the surface of the skin? Well, all of these things like oils, skin oils, or leftover soap on your finger, that all had an effect on what happened on the Kirlian photograph. So how are you ever supposed to get reproducibility from one picture to the next with so many variables to deal with that were ancillary to what you're trying to look at? In
right.
other words, you know, even sweating, how sweaty your finger was or something. So I said, okay, we're not going to fool around with this. To get to the important non-physical thing that may be going on, I'm going to put the gas between two pieces of glass. The gas alone is going to be between two pieces of glass. The electrodes are going to be on the outside of the glass, and I don't care whether you got chocolate all over your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to touch the glass itself. You can on the one side, the side of the that you don't put high voltage on. One side you have an electrode that's semi-transparent with high voltage, and the other side you have grounded. So you can bring your hand all the way up to the grounded side of this sandwich size device. It turned out you didn't even have to put your hands right on the surface of that size. Certainly you don't want to put your other hand on the high voltage side. And
right.
I had it rigged so that you didn't shock yourself accidentally in the dark in particular. So if you put your hands around this device and you, well, okay, let me back up. If you crank the voltage up to a certain voltage, now I'm not going to talk about the gas that's inside this cell that I injected inside here. We'll leave that for another time. But if you crank the voltage up enough, the cell, the detector of the cell would just glow, just like you would expect with a fluorescent tube or
right.
a neon tube,
right.
okay? Just like that, all right? Now, if you only turn the voltage up to two-thirds, let's say you needed 5,000 volts to make the thing glow, okay, what if you only turned it up to 4,000 or 3,000? Well, you don't expect anything to happen with the detector because it's not a high enough voltage to operate on its own. Now, you bring your hands around the detector and you concentrate on the detector, concentrate on making the gas glow, and all of a sudden it comes on.
Oh, man.
And you could even make it work from a distance just concentrating mentally.
So not even having your hand near the detector.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. Now, it took me a year to build this thing. You have no idea the technical stuff involved there was a joke at one point by one of the people who work with me, because he says, if you write a paper on this, it's only going to be one sentence. And I said, I know, but this had to do with getting gold. Gold had the right transparency in the dark with blue light coming out of the detector to be mostly transparent. So I had to be able to get a thin layer of gold on the outside surfaces of these glass plates.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have no idea how much work and how many months until I finally found the one guy at the Sandia Laboratories in Albuquerque, the one guy on the entire planet who knew how to make the gold stick onto the glass. In a sputtering machine. But my coworker joked about that and said, yes, when you write up the paper on it, all you're going to be saying is gold was deposited on the glass. Not that it took 9 months to make that sentence accurate. So that's, I'm just giving you a little insight into experimental scientific work. So that was the detector I invented, and I fired it up for the first time the night right before Father's Day, and it was working. I remember calling my own dad in the morning. I worked all night, and in the morning I called my dad and said, this thing I've been working on actually worked. I was so startled that it worked the first time.
Well, that is amazing. Now, I'm thinking... I know we had a discussion, we had emailed back and forth, and I had presented this kind of idea of, and we had a big discussion about quantum, mechanics and different aspects of that, and you told me something very simple that made a lot of sense to me, and I think it's somehow, and I'm not a scientist, obviously, but it seems to be related to this research you were doing, that you were describing. And I think and I'm trying to remember the exact sentence you gave me, but it's something like that matter vibrates in and out of our perceived reality.
Yeah.
Is this related to this phantom leaf kind of thing and what you're talking about here?
Well, only in that that's such a general statement to say that if you're dealing with matter, which of course we are
right.
on this planet, that yes, it relates in that way,
mm-hmm.
but it's not strictly speaking involved with how the detector operates.
Oh, okay.
Let me continue a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
Let me give you a little side footnote. The reason I first made that point a number of years ago when I was at Stanford, there was a friend of mine who was, I called it the big marble shooter, but the Stanford Linear Accelerator.
Right.
Many people had experiments they were doing at the Stanford Linear Accelerator up the hill from Stanford, up in the kind of the rolling foothills. Underground was the big accelerator. And a person I know was doing these experiments where he was shooting very fast beams at 90 degrees to each other, and every once in a while, there wasn't a reaction. There was nothing. And he says, I know the beams aren't out of alignment or anything, but they're, and I said, well, that's because you have to picture that each of these particles that are going along are blinking in and out of our reality. And I said, they're vibrating at what we call a vibration is in and out of our reality. And as a result of that, I said, it stands to reason that there's going to be some point when you're shooting all these marbles, picture the marbles coming from two directions towards the center point. And I said, there's going to be some point where one or the other of the marbles is just at the point of being completely blinked out of our reality.
Right.
So I said, there's not going to be any reaction at that point, because there's nothing there
right.
for the one marble to hit.
Right.
Okay, and so he said, well, that's all fine and dandy, but I can't write that up in a paper. I said, well, that's your problem, not mine. I said, just because science refuses to move a step forward in the real direction, that's not my problem. So,
right.
But so that's what I meant by
okay.
by their actual physical experiments where goofy things like that happen, and it's all because conventional science does not recognize how matter blinks in and out of our reality.
Yeah.
Now, for me to explain that more, I have to get into electromagnetic fields and power, the power between an electric and magnetic field, and I'm not sure we want to go down that road right now.
Yeah, because I would love to. We'll have maybe a part two if we do. I'd like to do a part two with more on that. And unfortunately, we only get an hour for this show. But I would love to do that. You know, on a to get into more detail about that.
Well, let me go back to the detector for a minute.
Yeah,
move forward now.
Yeah.
So that was on Father's Day in 1976 that it first worked, and for the next several years, I was just blown away because I then invented another thing that splits the non-physical component. Okay, I'm demonstrating that there's a non-physical energy that comes out of your hands, right?
Right.
Okay, the detector's reacting to something coming out of your hands. It's not sweat, it's not what you washed your hands with, or not chocolate on your fingers mm-hmm. or anything, because this is some energy that goes through the glass and affects the gas inside the detector, right?
Right.
So I'm showing the non-physical energies, and my whole reason for doing this was because I hoped that there was psychic research was so stuck at that time, and I was so dumb and naive to think that it was stuck by sheer ignorance on the part of science. I didn't know it was purposely being stuck. Stuck with an ED on the end. Okay, I'm turning something into a verb.
Right,
okay?
Right.
It was purposely being denied by what we would now call the deep state, and, you know, what we can leave that there for now.
Mm-hmm.
But because I thought if I showed some very definitive experiments that there was something worth looking at, that there were other energies, and here's a way to show there are other energies we don't presently recognize, that other scientists could get on board and we could move psychic phenomena down the road just like any other science and learn from it.
Right.
Okay, the only thing we had was Russ Targ and Hal put up the road in a mile, who had gobs of money
mm-hmm.
coming in from the CIA, and all they're doing is remote viewing, which is as old as the hills. They just put a new name on, you know, they put lipstick on the pig.
Okay.
there was nothing new about going, they kind of regimented it and made it a formula. Form of it, but they were showing, you know, from a distance you could look in on something and spy. They wanted it for spying,
right? Exactly.
And that's all that's all we had in this, you know, and a lot of anecdotal stuff. People were doing experiments, but it was all anecdotal, and there was always the naysayers, you know, the amazing Randys. That were saying, oh, no, there's nothing to this. So I thought, damn it, I'm going to do some real experiments, and I'm going to show there's something here and let other people reproduce it. Well, let them build their equipment and find the same things out. Well, yeah, that was sure dumb of me to think that that was how science could progress. So as a result, so after 4 years of doing experiments with this detector, showing that other things didn't affect it, well, how do you know it's not a Geiger counter? It works like a Geiger counter. So I'd bring radiation sources in, and it had no effect on the detector. And I also showed that this other energy could be split out of a beam of light and affect the detector. So picture a prism on a rotating clock face type thing, and you've got the detector sitting at one position, and you have a light source at another position, and you're shining the light through a prism, and in a direction where there's no light supposed to be coming out, all of a sudden the detector would start to chatter.
Hmm.
And if you calculated the angles with the physics of beams, if you calculate the angle, this light energy was faster than the speed of light.
Oh, wow.
In other words, it had the opposite index of refraction, if I can get technical for a minute,
right,
from positive light. So these were the experiments I was doing. Very, very interesting stuff. Very,
well, yeah,
you know, super duper good stuff. And then we get to about 1980, and all of a sudden this professor says, "Well, we're out of money. Sorry." And this leaves me hanging. Now, this is 4 years into, 4 to 5 years into what would have been a PhD thesis. 2,000 experiments. And I had to sit it all up on a shelf, pretend I never did it, and start all over again with some conventional Silicon Valley type work, because that was where the funding could come in.
Now, it seems to me, now you mentioned the deep state, you mentioned, you know, them just worrying about spying and using stuff that, you know, as old as the hills. What do they want to, and when I say they, those that have the power and so forth, and the purse strings, they don't want us to know what you found out.
No, they do not, and that's why I said I was so naive at that time.
Yeah.
I didn't realize at that young age and at that time that there were people in secret laboratories who already knew about all this stuff, and that it was to be kept for them, not for you and me to use, maybe for healing purposes. I had so many professional psychics. So many people came into my lab during the time I was doing these experiments because word got around that Ed's got this weird detector, and it became. You remember when the Muppet Show was on TV?
Yeah, yeah.
Remember the Great Muppet Show?
Yeah.
Well, everybody wanted to be on the Muppet Show.
Oh, sure.
Okay, you know, everybody had something. I remember Beverly Sills, the opera singer.
Yeah.
Beverly Sills, the great opera singer. She says, "I always wanted to tap dance, and I got to tap dance on the Muppet Show."
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
And so it was kind of like that. Everybody was calling up and saying, "Hey, I want to try out that detector of yours."
Mm-hmm.
And so all kinds of people did experiments with it, and it worked great for everybody except one person. It would not work the day Ingo Swann came in.
Oh, wow.
And I will mention his name because he's gone now. And later on, I checked with my guides.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it wasn't working. And when they were gone, and this famous professor and Ingo were gone from my lab, back to his office. later, I was mulling it over, and my guides, by that I mean my, you know, you could call them the voices in my head or my guides, and that's a whole other area to talk about, you know, if you're channeling messages and stuff,
yes.
The people, the non-physical people who work with me on
right.
this project, like Tesla,
mm-hmm.
And others, and they said we had to stop the cell from working. And I said, well, why in this case? He said, because Ingo's going to go back over to SRI.
Mm.
And he's going to tell them what, if it worked, he's going to, now he goes back to SRI and says, oh, that crazy guy over there at Stanford, it's all baloney, nothing works.
Right.
They said, we are protecting you from what would happen if it was said by somebody with some authority, like Ingo, that I had an operating device.
So if it would have worked, you probably wouldn't be talking to me right now.
Well, that's right. Who knows what? All I can tell you is what my guides said to me was, right, this is for your protection.
And my guides are telling me I need to talk to you. So
yeah, right.
Isn't that something?
Right, exactly. That's how I knew you were the right person to do an interview with for the first time in many years.
Well, speaking of the government and those in power and so forth, I kind of got on a radar, like I've told you about, when I published my first book, and there are government people who are interested in, they want to test you, right? They want to see what you can do. And I have this thing on my computer. I'm looking at it right now. It's from the old 60s British television series, The Prisoner.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a picture of Patrick McGoohan, and it says, I am not a number, I am a free man. And I really live by that. I don't want to get hooked up with those guys, because everything I've heard is when you do, you go down into a black box and you're never a free person. You're for the rest of your life and probably beyond. You cannot do what you want to do in your life, and you have no control. You can't travel. You can't do anything. It can be that restrictive. So
yes.
So that your guides were protecting you, and they are protecting me too. And here we are talking about it on the radio for the good folks out there, or on the podcast. Sorry, I said radio. That's old-fashioned, I guess.
That's okay.
And I still think of it as radio. And people are going to listen to this, and they're going to wonder, what can they do? What is going on? What can they do? What can, a person do?
Well, first thing is to be aware that this kind of situation has prevailed for a long time. Now, I don't want this to sound negative, because instead of a period at the end of that statement, it requires a semicolon, because this is a compound sentence. That's the way things have prevailed for a long time, but those ones who have been in those positions of power are now on their way out.
Yeah.
They're now losing power. The frequency of the planet is going up. They are becoming more and more uncomfortable and unable to function. And you are watching right now on the world stage the hissy fit of the last gasps, I guess I would say, of these people trying to hold on to the power, part of which is what you were just talking about, working on secret projects.
Right. And like I was told by my father, the most dangerous animal in the woods is the wounded animal.
Absolutely.
So we do have being good people, good people doing good work, which I know you are, and I am too, even if I say so myself. But
you are. Yeah.
You've told me that too, so I believe it. We have to be on our guard. And for our listeners who are doing the work, the good work, and trying to help humanity, trying to help people, the everyday people, which our parents are good representatives of those salt-of-the-earth kind of people that I would like to help. We have to be on our guard, but also realize what you're talking about. And, we've run out of time, but, this is going to have to be a part two, and I know, we'll make it work. We'll make our schedules work together. But I just wanted to say one last thing, and just if it makes sense at all, kind of tying all this together, back to the implants and stuff, is where the extraterrestrials or the aliens operate, the realm in which they operate, the spirit realm in which, you know, psychics talk to those that have passed on, and the, you know, so-called, I don't know if you want to call it quantum realm or whatever, it's all the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but it's different different levels, different frequency ranges.
Right,
You know, you can say you're in the building, you know, but the lingerie's on floor four, and, you know, and the golf clubs are on floor six.
Right.
There's different frequencies. So, you know, and you can't paint with a wide brush about aliens. You've got good ones and you've got bad ones.
There's right.
Some that aren't very advanced spiritually and other ones that are so far advanced we have trouble comprehending them other than calling them gods.
Yeah. And I think we're both lucky enough to have such good advisors.
You mean unseen advisors?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, I knew this was going to happen. We were going to get into such a great conversation, and there's so much to cover. And you warned me about that too when I told you some of the things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So we're going to have we're going to have to do a part two. But I think we did a pretty good job for a part one to get to people, you know, whet people's appetites about what the research you did and how important it is and how dangerous it is to those in power that have been in power but are now in the decline, but still dangerous. So just one last thing. Can people get a hold of you and read some of the things you've done? I mean, how can they do that?
Well, maybe you should put with my biography. I forgot to put this in the statement I gave you that you were reading from before. Mm-hmm. My website. Once I stopped publishing due to that, we can get into that another time.
Right.
Once
right.
I stopped, I still had to be. The bad guys thought they had stopped me at that point, and I. So what I did was open a website to make the books of the spiritual messages in my magazine were the most sought after.
Yeah.
So there's two books. And all the messages past what was bound in those two books are all on my website for free. The books are available for a decent price, and all the other messages are there, including any new stuff I'm asked to write.
Right.
That's on a website called Wisdom of the Rays, R-A-Y-S .com. WisdomOfTheRays.com, and you can put that in, you know, in the written stuff that people can see if they go to.
I will do that, Ed.
And there's a one more sentence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a public contact me.
Okay.
There, I don't want to give out my private email address right now, but
right.
but I do have a public email address there. You know, you can click on the button, or you can just type in your header of your email, just publisher@wisdomoftherays.com.
Okay. All right.
So,
yeah, thank you.
So either hit the contact button or just type in publisher@wisdomoftherays.com.
Okay. I will make sure that's on there. And, okay, I want to thank you, Ed, and I'm sorry that we ran out of time, but we will get together again, part two, and there'll probably be a part three, too, I have a feeling.
It's called the continuing conversation.
Exactly, continuing conversations that we're having. Okay, thank you very much, Ed. And
thank you for providing a forum, Bruce. Much appreciated avenue that's long overdue, but
yes.
In another sense, this is the perfect timing. I'm being told this is now the time.
Oh, good. I think so too. I know that's why we were put together.
Yep.
Okay. To close things out, I'd like to thank my producer Scotty Z, the Z Man, as he's known as. And thank all of you for listening to Timeless Esoterica on artistfirst.com. You can also find me at bruceolavsolheim.com, my website. And this is Dr. Bruce, the Paranormal Professor, signing off until the fourth Monday of the next month. Until then, keep an open mind and open heart. Live forever. Stay in the light and remember, I believe in you.